welcome to myself, Max McGillivray from Beanstalk Global. Great pleasure to have you on today. And if you're watching live on Facebook or LinkedIn, hello. If you're watching on the record on YouTube or on the podcast, hello as well. So let's get into it, because this is going to be a really seminal broadcast. Three key industry professionals have come together to create a unique group called Healthy and Sustainable Food. This is to constantly examine what would be the results if people from different sectors were to collaborate on solutions to produce healthy, sustainable food ongoing. The founders we have here, Barbara Bray, MBE, Director, Alio Solutions. Barbara, say hello.
Hello.
We have Mark Driscoll, Director, Tasting the Future. Mark, say hello.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
We have Jackie Green, Director of Veritas Associates. Jackie, say hello.
Hello.
And their collective aim is to improve nutritional quality of food and availability for all social economic groups in the UK. They will do this by bringing individuals from different sectors together for projects on sustainable nutrition. Beanstalk is very, very proud to be hosting a series of monthly broadcasts for the great Healthy and Sustainable Food Group. And Barbara, help me. What's this? Is this the fifth or the sixth?
It's the fifth. Yeah, it's building momentum.
And it's getting better and better, especially as all the speakers have been brilliant. We've just been working out the tech RN, so we're getting more and more coverage in the UK and internationally. So it's really helping the group's aims. So today we go live with the group broadcast on the important subject of the potential positives of the healthcare sector and the food industry collaborating. We investigate with the three group founders, as well as key industry experts, as to whether there's significantly more potential to be had from such collaboration, or whether it is fraught with issues. And we will invite them in shortly, but our expert speakers include Rachel Thompson from the World Obesity Federation, Rob Hancock, PhD from Advanced Plant Growth Centre, and Dr. Kyle Stewart from the Watercress Research Limited. So Barbara, why did you want to go down this route with Jackie and Mark? Do you think this actual subject of fresh produce and healthcare collaboration, do you think it has mileage? What do you think, Barbara?
Yeah, I've seen it within my own consultancy, people starting to talk about what they can do differently and how they can make improvements. So I think we're stepping away from the food industry, just thinking about innovation as in a bit more product development, and actually thinking about, from a healthy and sustainable point of view, what can land. But on the flip side, the pharmaceutical industry, looking at how can you take actives from plants and use them for the benefit of, you know, disease and curing things. So it's been interesting, the journey that I think we've all been on in the last few weeks and months, to understand what the opportunities are.
And Mark, do you think there's actual commercial opportunities for fresh produce companies to go down this route, that they could actually generate additional income, or perhaps significantly more income, by collaborating on this basis with healthcare companies?
Absolutely. And we do face a kind of double crises. We face an ecological crisis and a health crisis, and the private sector have a really, really important role to play. And often consumers or citizens are more driven, you know, after price. It's usually health and well-being that drives consumer decision making. And I think the fresh produce sector is in a ideal position to take advantage and offer healthy, nutritious, nutrient-dense products to meet both the health and sustainability concerns of their customers and consumers more generally.
Well said, Mark, because you're not going to be able to collaborate with healthcare companies if you're manufacturing ball bearings. But when it comes to fresh produce, crikey, it's to me, as everyone's going to find out, the possibilities are endless. Jackie, with your background of running one of the biggest fresh produce companies in the UK, were you already aware of these potential collaborations, or is this new ground to you as well?
No, I think certainly aware of the possible collaborations, but it feels like it's really through lockdown that we've managed to pull these groups of people together to open up some of these dialogues. It's a shame it takes that to facilitate it. But as Barbara said, in my work as well, I'm finding increasingly an overlap. And I guess with global influences as well, with nutrition being completely interlinked with healthcare in other countries and continents, you're starting to see people recognise that. I think this sort of view that fresh produce is inherently healthy is a bit outdated, and actually being more specific and intentional about its healthcare properties and the sort of sustainability side of it is vital, and we just need to be better informed. So I'm really excited about the panel today. I think it's going to be a great broadcast.
Well, on our call about a week ago with the expert panelists, I've been very excited with some of the, well, you're not planning meetings alike, they're like planning meetings, but the one that we had on this one was just, I was just so excited, I couldn't wait for this day. So let's get everyone in. Rachel, Rob, Carl, can you come in and join us, please? Fantastic. So what we're going to do, let's just set the agenda for this. I'm just going to run around our three experts so they could just introduce themselves and who they work for, who they represent. And then I'm going to do a deep dive interview with each of them for about 10 minutes. And that's going to take us through to about 3:30 UK time. But then we're going to go into a big Q&A. So if you've got questions, start sending them through via Zoom or wait to hear what the speakers have got to say, then send them in. But we'd love to have your participation. And then when we get to the end of the broadcast, we're going to get all of our experts, including our founders, to summarize. So let's go from the top. Rob, can you just tell us who you are and who you represent, please?
Yes, I'm Rob Hancock. I'm a senior research scientist at the James Hutton Institute, where I've been working for about the last 25 years.
Fantastic. And Rob, thank you very much for making it into the office today. That's much appreciated. And Rachel, can you tell us who you are and who you represent, please?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rachel Thompson. I'm a policy advisor at the World Obesity Federation, where I work on obesity policy with a global perspective.
Fantastic. And last but not least, Dr. Carl Stewart. Carl, can you tell everyone who you are, please?
I'm Kyle. I'm a GP in South Devon, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Watercress Research Limited.
And Kyle, shall we mention about our little facet that we've got to introduce today, that there's the great Tom Amory and his colleagues at the Watercress Company. They've stated that we've got to mention Watercress as much as possible today to big up the product and also to big up the Watercress Company. So Rob, I've forgotten the name of your company. Could you just nominate it again, please?
Sorry, yeah, I'm with the James Hutton Institute.
Sorry, Rob. And Carl, can you nominate your company?
Watercress Research.
And Rob, can you just confirm that your favourite fresh produce is Watercress?
I love Watercress.
Excellent. And Rachel, can you just confirm as well?
I can confirm.
Excellent. We're going to get some money in the pot. So let's start off with Rob, please. Could everyone turn off the videos apart from Rob? And Rob, if it's okay, I just want to give a background, especially for the people on the podcast, because they really do appreciate having quite a lot of information on all of our speakers. So, Rob, I'm just going to give your background, if that's okay. So, Rob Hancock, PhD, is a group biochemist and physiologist with 25 years post-qualification experience. His primary interests are concerned with the biochemical detriments and impact of biotic and abiotic stress on crop quality. He works extensively with key sectors of the food industry, ranging from primary production to retail, to develop tools and technologies to improve crop yields and nutritional and sensory quality via breeding, management, and agronomy. He's published extensively in the scientific literature and is the holder of several patents describing innovations in crop production. He has previously worked with UK growers using chemical and physical methods for the biofortification of mineral and organic nutrients in crops, and is currently developing methods of vitamin biofortification in indoor farms in collaboration with a major UK retailer. His interests in biofortification have led to collaboration with the University of Nairobi in Kenya to accelerate the development of high iron and zinc bean cultivars to tackle significant dietary deficiencies. He's presently the scientific lead of the Advanced Plant Growth Centre, a £27 million capital investment to develop a global hub for research into controlled environment and precision agriculture, and is due to open at the James Hutton Institute in Dundee in 2023. Rob, have I summarised that okay?
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary of the last 25 years of my career. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let me just start off with a very aggressive question. Rob, what's the point of you? What's the point of what you do? Surely we don't need to help our plant species and any more in the way that they're already helping themselves. What's the point of you, Rob?
So, well, here's an example of what the point of me is. If you look across the UK alone, there are potentially around over 10 million people who are potentially calcium deficient. There are something like almost 30 million people who are potentially magnesium deficient. and there are perhaps 30 million people who are potentially potassium deficient. So part of the research that we try to do is obviously one way that this can be addressed is by changing people's diets, but we've been trying to do that for a long time. I'm sure Rachel will have something to say about this and some of the difficulties that exist around trying to alter people's diets. So if we can't alter people's diets, can we then alter the density of the things that they actually are eating? If we can't persuade people to eat their five a day, can we provide them with two a day, which are as nutritionally dense as their five a day, perhaps?
Fantastic. Okay.
And you know, there are several ways in which we can address this and which we can do it. But really, to achieve this with any degree of success, because if it was simple, I'm sure if innovative farmers would be going out there and just doing it for themselves without any help from the likes of me. But because we are growing crops in a variable environment, and those crops have got variable genetics, we really need to understand the mechanisms which are underpinning some of those things. And if we can understand the mechanisms, then we can accelerate the improvement of those crops for the consumer. So that's really what I'm about, trying to understand those mechanisms to accelerate improvements.
So treat me as the layman that I am. How advanced is the technology? How advanced is your development? Are you on a supermarket shelf now, or are you coming to market soon? Where are you in this journey, in this process, please?
So, I mean, certainly there have been crops that have been bred for nutritional density. An example being brassicas that were bred by what was once the IFR, the Institute for Food Research, I think is now the Quadram Institute, that were bred for high glucosinolates. And I'm sure we'll hear a lot more about glucosinolates from Kyle later on. There's also an awful lot going on around management of these crops, and there are biotechnological approaches which are available. But in terms of getting things onto the market, onto the supermarket shelves, I think one of the issues which is acting as a barrier is perhaps recognition by the ultimate consumer of some of these different metabolites and different nutrient requirements, and it's the capacity to actually market these things in a way which can appeal.
Okay, so you are an intellectual powerhouse. I'm going to have to speak for the audience here. If we've got the likes of fluoride in our water to help health issues, are we inferring that we should be putting developments that yourself and your team can create into our food or positively manipulating our food to give us that new health regime?
Absolutely.
If we're not going to take it ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And an example of that, there was a while when one of the retailers was marketing and selling various fresh produce that was enriched in selenium, for example. So that has occurred in the past. And also at the moment, I think there's fresh produce out there which is enriched in vitamin D. And certainly there are some interests from the retailers in continuing to enrich in certainly vitamins, because I think they see that as being an opportunity that they can sell to the consumer. Some mineral enrichment, I think, is more difficult. And some of the other nutrients which are known to have beneficial effects, but which are not vitamins, I think it's certainly something that we should be exploring. But again, it's something that we're maybe the consumer's not quite ready for.
Okay, so let's get out the proverbial crystal ball. Where would you like your colleagues, your sector of specialism to be 10 years down the line, please?
I would like us to be able to go to any company or to work with any retailer or producer and say to them, well, what nutrients would you like us to enrich? Wow. Here's a way we can do it, either through breeding or potentially through biotechnology or through management.
Okay, and to assist you, because we've got this, in effect, this open forum, and all of us have got significant contacts within the trade, fresh produce trade, and elsewhere, UK and internationally, what can we do collectively? If we could give you the proverbial magic wand, Rob, to assist you to create this goal 10 years down the line, what would you like from us?
I'd like you to clearly articulate what it is that you'd like to see and where you'd like to get to, because I think what we're trying to do as a research community is we are constantly coming up with innovations that we think the market wants and that we think the market might like. But I think if we had a greater steer and greater direction from the market, I think our focus could be much more closely aligned to what it is that the companies actually want.
Okay, because I suppose that then puts into the dilemma of, and we've spoken about this so many times on this broadcast, shareholder value? Where do you say the retailers want to go? Is it all about the bottom line? Is there going to be a chief financial officer of a particular retailer who gets introduced to you next week, 6 months, a year down the line, and says, Rob, this is fantastic. How are we going to make money out of this? Are we going to make money? Are we going to be able to sell more beetroot enhanced with your technology and stop people eating pop-up tarts because they enjoy beetroot better than pop-up? And are we, the retailer, going to make money? Should we be looking at it on that basis, or should we?
Well, I mean, I think this is where also the quality and the sensory elements come into it, okay? And because, you know, so one element of quality is clearly the nutrients, but we can't forget things like flavour. And you know, in your fresh fruit, that's really important. And it's, you know, it's about sugar acid balance, but it's also about volatiles and aroma volatiles. And so really, I think it's important for us to have, and a lot of that ultimately comes from the biochemistry of the crop and the biochemistry of the product. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand that underpinning biochemistry and how it feeds into nutritional value, how it feeds into sensory value, but also how that then relates back to the genetics. And I think by having that complete understanding of all those different levels, we can get to where we need to be that much more quickly.
Yeah, and Rob, you made a really good point there. I'm but a marketeer, and I get very frustrated with the fresh produce sector that we don't have brands and larger marketing campaigns. And the excuse that's always been presented to me is because the growers, the suppliers, they don't make enough margin from the end customer, the retailers, to create brands. We had a fantastic guy, Richard Diplock, who runs the Sussex Greenhouse, which is a major tomato producer. And so I had this argument with him on a broadcast such as this, and he actually put me back by saying, Max, yeah, brands are all important, but actually I think, Max, what is more important is taste. If you get a bunch of school kids coming in and picking a tomato off the vine and eating it, you could just see the wonder in their eyes. And then we've heard, Max, lots of stories of those kids going to their parents saying, can we have tomatoes? Can we have tomatoes? So I fully agree with you about that taste element.
I think also as we move into a more sort of controlled environment farming, and we can increase the level of control that we've got over that environment, we can improve that consistency, because it's not just about it tasting good this time, but it's every time you buy it.
Yeah, understood. I can't tell you this, but Tom from the Watercress Company said that if we mention watercress, his ultimate boss is actually going to donate to charity as many times as we say watercress. I haven't actually seen which charity it is, but we'll find out. But hopefully we can do more with watercress. What do you think, Rob? Do you like watercress still?
Oh, absolutely. And I think watercress is an ideal crop for perhaps some of the controlled environment farming.
Boom. No, but seriously, Rob, before we move on to Rachel, I gave you this magic wand to wave to create the success 10 years down the line. But today, over and above finding out what the retailers want, what the consumer wants, would you like to be able to collaborate with more fresh produce businesses or consultants or suppliers or other people with innovative... Go on, fire away. You tell me what you want.
I mean, you know, it's clear that a lot of this is high risk, okay? And you know, some of it may or may not come to fruition within a time period that's appropriate. But there is government support there to actually support some of this work, and government recognises the risk involved. And really, what a lot of this is about is working with private businesses to leverage that government support to get the research done that we need doing to take things forward.
Okay, so I need you to be succinct and direct with us. What sort of companies would you like to come knocking on your door to assist you, to partner with you, to collaborate with you? What sort of companies?
Growers, retailers, cooperatives, management companies, crop management companies, indoor growers.
Brilliant. Fantastic. There we go. Call to action. All of those individuals you've just heard, Rob, he would love to collaborate with you and him and his colleagues. So let's get in contact with Rob on that basis. Rob, stay there. Rachel, can you come on in, please? So Rob, just stay there. And Rachel's internet or our connection's a little bit laggy, so we'll just excuse. So Rachel, with the World Obesity Federation, have you had contacts with the likes of Rob before? Is there any link between yourselves collaborating that way?
Yeah, thanks, Max, and thanks, everyone. I actually know this is a really new and exciting environment and audience for me to be amongst. And yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. This is, I have to say, like out of my comfort zone. I'm not normally talking about these kind of really technical academic issues related to food technology and innovation. So it's really exciting to be here. And I think there is a lot, certainly there is a lot more that I would like to do to collaborate with Rob and colleagues and really kind of push the barriers of what we can do. And I'm really really pleased to hear Rob talking about the importance of desirability of food, whether that's in terms of taste, and I think brand is also another point that I might come back to. But I think it's and also the behavior change is something that I might pick up on. But not enough collaboration would be the starting point.
Excellent. Okay, thank you, Rachel. Rob, could you, as our rock star number one, and what a rock star, could you just turn off your video so that I can have a catch up with Rachel, and Rob will bring you back in a little bit later. And Rachel, if it's okay, I'm just going to give a little bit of briefer of your background, as we did with Rob, especially for the people on the podcast. So Rachel Thompson has experience spanning international development, global health and food systems, the common thread being a commitment to promote equity in health and beyond. She's worked with the Red Cross movement and several NGOs and field-based roles across Africa and Asia. Back home in the UK, she's worked as a researcher at Chatham House and consulted for the Overseas Development Institute and Women in Global Health. Rachel is currently a policy advisor at the World Obesity Federation, where she leads advocacy work with UN agencies to advance multi-sector action on obesity. So Rachel, let's give you the same question that we gave Rob. And sorry if it's slightly aggressive, but I think it's a great way to elicit an answer. What's the point of Rachel? What's the point of the World Obesity Federation, please?
Sure. Well, I think to start with, it's quite an easy one to answer, because I think we're all aware obesity is a huge health problem. And of course, COVID has brought that into the spotlight with a very strong force. And we are seeing the evidence emerging even greater every day on those links. And this is this is really an urgent time to be addressing COVID, but also obesity, because obesity is, you're more likely to die from COVID if you have obesity. But even if you don't get COVID in the kind of the bigger picture, before COVID, after COVID, who knows if that's going to happen, you are going to be living with lifelong ill health, and that's likely to die earlier. And at the same time, we also know that many people around the world are still suffering from undernutrition. So we have this really bizarre situation where we have nearly 2 billion people overweight or with obesity, and I think it's around 500,000 underweight and malnourished that way, but many more in between, in this kind of grey area of certainly not eating 7 portions of fruit and veg a day and not optimising their health therefore. So we really have a food system that is not delivering for health, and we have a health system that I would argue from obesity anyway, like you don't generally get treated for obesity, obesity is not prevented within the health system, nutrition is not enough in the health system. So the point of me is to help change this and to really drive global action on obesity. So I do work, I'm based in the UK, but I mainly work internationally with at the kind of the UN policy level, where we are seeing, again, thanks to COVID, actually, because of the attention on obesity and COVID, a real opportunity for action. Of course, in the UK, we've seen it with our own Prime Minister here. So I'm an advocate at heart. That is what I do. I'm not an academic, and I'm not a politician, but I'm going to be talking about what we should be doing, basically. on to tackle obesity, which I believe is certainly one of the greatest health challenges of my generation.
Well, Rachel, if anyone could do it, you can do it, because you could just feel the passion coming out of the but the computer. I'm sure face to face, you're even more passionate on this subject. Just give us a bit of a headline. Why are we in this issue of obesity? And just this, I always forget this peculiarity that half, just making numbers up, half the world is overweight and half the world is undernourished. Why has this happened? Why is this imbalance? I'm going to pick on the big food brands. Is it because the marketing for food has been so proficient? We used the saying that the other day when we were doing a broadcast in Mexico, that wherever you've been in the world, two people have been there before you. The guy selling Michael Jackson t-shirts and the guy selling Coca-Cola. And if you look at Mexico with the problems that they have with people drinking Coca-Cola instead of water, because the way that is it the food companies that have created this massive imbalance, or is it just us being stupid humans? Well, it's a naive question, but please give me an answer.
Yeah, sure. Well, it is, at this point, it is very easy to go down kind of a lefty rabbit hole of, oh, it's all capitalism, it's all the market, the neoliberalism. And yes, it is, but I don't feel that's a particularly helpful answer, especially when living in this world as we do. And revolution would maybe help, but probably would cause a lot of violence and destruction too. So we do, of course, know that we live in a market-driven world, and it's easier to make money from cheaper foods. And at the moment, all the incentives are that the way the economic incentives align is that ultra processed foods, high in sugar, fat, salt, tend to sell very easily and very well, and are cheap to produce. So what we've seen in the last 30 years is just the flooding of our food environments with these products, and they taste good and people want them. And of course, as we know, at the same time, the aggressive marketing, strategic marketing, advertising that has become such a part of our lives that we don't even know it now, that, you know, all the subliminal stuff that goes on. We also need to looking at obesity, it is a very complex disease. It's a very complex issue. It's not only the food we eat. Of course, it is also genetics, may also be related to, you know, psychology, individual mental health issues, poverty in some places, it's linked, in other places, it's linked with wealth and affluence. So it's so complex. It's the interaction between the genetics, our biology, and the environment. And we can't change genetics so easily, especially when our genetics are still programmed for when we were, you know, living in times of famine, which we still are, and many people still are, unfortunately. But we can change our environments, and yes, governments have a role to play in that, but so does the whole of society, and certainly so does the food industry.
Rachel, well done. And so do you think one of the get out of jails for this is the collaboration between food and the health sectors? Do you think if there's more collaboration, this would help us cure this indifference and this obesity issue?
I think, certainly for obesity, because it is such a complex, multi-factor issue, we can't just tackle it in the health sector. We can't just tackle it in the food sector. So there has to be a level of collaboration. And what I guess I'm frustrated at is when I sit in these, or used to sit, or now sit in these Zoom meetings with policymakers at the kind of policy level, where we love the jargon, collaboration, innovation, coordination, but we don't do it very well. Yes, there are examples that nice platforms can get set up. I know in India, there's a kind of I think they have a joint multi-sector plan on non-communicable diseases, so obesity, but also diabetes and all these things. And they have the agricultural sector in there, and that's great. And in some places that does work. In the UK, I know the Royal Society of Public Health did a lot of great work with bringing in farmers to really empower them as custodians of health as well as land. So it does happen, but not enough, and not necessarily enough with the private sector, who actually are, of course, they're at the kind of the front line of individuals and communities' interaction with the food environment. So I do believe that we need more collaboration. I think that we are only going to tackle these big complex challenges if we work together. And I think a lot of that is about breaking down kind of misconceptions sometimes, and certainly working on obesity, or anyone working in public health, we have a mistrust of the private sector and of the food industry, because a lot of our work is about the bad guys and the importance in advocating for regulation, like sugar taxes, of course, you know, not marketing to children, things like that. But I feel like that's at the detriment of us actually looking at more on the positives of collaboration and what can be done. If we were to start having conversations that we're just not enough. And that's why, yeah, as I said, it's really exciting to be here and engaging with you and your audience. Really an open invitation to the fresh produce sector to get in touch. And I'd also love to know if people are actually already collaborating with parts of the health sector and that I don't know about, because I think that's another thing. I'm working at the sort of policy level, but I might actually not know about the kind of the more local practice going on.
Rachel, well done. I we discussed it in some other broadcasts. It's on certain subjects, whether it be like diversity in boardrooms, it's trying to drive behavioral change. And if we can get that family to go into a supermarket or a market and buy good stuff instead of bad stuff, we've all won. But it's how we create that magic dust in the first place to persuade them to go down that route. But then again, if you look just in the UK, the snapshots over this last six months, 9 months, I don't know if you know the stats, that we've seen an upsurge of the likes of vegetable and salads, of a 30% uptick as people have been scratch cooking from home. So as we get out of the pandemic and the lockdown, you'd hope that people have enjoyed that and will continue to do that. Or when they start to go out, they'll choose those healthier options, and perhaps those restaurants and other outlets will start to serve more food. And there's another conversation to be had about plant-based foods, which are on the ascendancy, as well as plant health. But again, let's have another call to action. Anyone who wants to collaborate with Rachel from the fresh produce sector, let's do that. And Rachel, when we get out of this, I'd love you to either meet up in London, or if you can come up here. My local pub does a mean watercress soup. Would you like to have a plate of watercress soup with me?
Oh, Max, I love watercress. It's definitely, watercress is definitely one of my favourite salad items.
Fantastic. Rachel, stay there. Kyle, can you come in, please? So, Kyle, as a medical doctor, Kyle, just curious as to, have you had collaboration with the likes of the World Obesity Federation? Or is that just out of your radar because you're so busy doing your day-to-day? Or are there links within yourself and the medical profession? And again, it's a naive question, but I'd love to know.
Yeah, so hi, everyone. So the truth is, no, we haven't had any engagement with people like the Obesity Federations. Our journey with the watercress stuff that we're doing is obviously very new, and we've been very focused on the science. I think once we're up and running, making products, then absolutely we want to start the collaboration. I mean, as a GP in the Southwest, we see the consequences of poor nutrition.
Yeah.
And it's very, very clear, you know, to see families getting torn apart by cardiovascular disease, strokes, and other conditions. So one of our aims with the project that we're working on is to see if we can tackle that and collaborate in the future.
Well done, Carl. Stop there. Rachel, can you just turn off your video and we'll bring you back in? That's Rachel Thompson going off. Rockstar number two. Come on to rockstar number three. Carl, I'm just going to give you the big rah-rah, as I said previously, with our other two expert speakers for all those folk on the podcast, because they can't see how handsome you are. So Dr. Carl Stewart, he is a GP partner in South Devon, what a gorgeous part of the country, as well as a trust doctor at Torbay Hospital, where he delivers the outpatient lumbar puncture service for the neurological team, and is currently creating a new app, the Clinician's Guide to Lumbar Punctures. Dr. Stewart is CEO and co-founder of Watercress Research Limited. Carl, can you just say the name of your company again?
Watercress Research.
Thank you. And holds an honorary clinical associate research fellowship in theoretical medicine at the University of Exeter, alongside an NHS England Clinical Entrepreneur Fellowship and a separate Mid-Essex, Southend and Basildon Medical Innovation Fellowship. He's the president of Torbay and District Medical Society and came runner-up in 2019's National GP Trainee of the Year Award. Wow. He has a consultancy company and works as an out-of-hours GP for Devon Docs as part of the 111 service. Carl, did I summarise that okay?
It was fantastic. Thank you.
So come on, I've asked this aggressive question of the other two speakers. What's the point of Dr. Carl Stewart, please?
What's the point of me? I think I've got the opportunity to try and demonstrate what we can do with phytochemicals. So these chemicals, which are implants, often hidden away, often not triggered, and look at ways that we can manipulate plants and prepare them to create new medicine. And I don't think we're wrong to be thinking about new medicines from plants. Not just what they can do for our health, but actual new medicines. Wow. And that's what I think we're on the verge of doing now.
So where did this come about? Because you're obviously such a busy chap anyway. When did you have this mercurial moment of thinking about watercress and being able to create goodness from watercress? How did that come about?
It came about from me being a junior doctor at Torbay Hospital. So I was on a ward round, saw very poorly baby with nappy rash, and they were septic from it. I did medical sciences as a degree alongside medicine, so I've always had an interest in biochemical pathways, and did a bit of research, found that the nappy rash from The nappy rash is a chemical burn from ammonia. That ammonia is produced via a bacterial urease enzyme, which catalyzes the reaction of urea to ammonia. And we did some investigating, and we found that historically, plants are known to have urease inhibitors, and it's likely they've got these to regulate nitrogen and help them with protein metabolism. So we were very fortunate in that we managed to get a grant from a local charity, Torbay Medical Research Fund, who we're absolutely indebted to for their support. And we put a research project together. So the three plants to start with were pomegranate, chamomile, and watercress. And pomegranate was full of seeds and had a thick skin and was quite seasonal. We didn't know what to do with it. Chamomile, we couldn't find anywhere fresh apart from in tea bags or if we drove down the M5 at the side of the motorway. But watercress was everywhere. And we very quickly put in the watercress company into Google, seeing what we could find. And I think within about half an hour of speaking to Tom Amory of the watercress company, and we've had a blossoming relationship since then. And we've done some pretty exciting work with watercress.
Fantastic. Can you just name that company again? There was an internet glitch. I didn't hear the name of the company.
The Watercress Company.
Excellent. So just, I'm going to just show my hand here. My father, now retired, is a doctor of biochemistry, and I remember sitting with him at his laboratory, University of Sussex, and he's did 30 odd years research into cancer research. And I, if it's okay, I mentioned about our broadcast that we were having, and specifically your background. And I basically accused my father, well, why didn't you come up with this? And he said, well, it's such a complex area that sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not. You can do years of research and not come across anything, or you can literally stumble across something and create miracles. So let's talk about this. I'm just going to call it a miracle, Carl. Where is your miracle going? What's the potential of it, please?
So we're fortunate in that we have two or three really promising projects at the minute. The first one being this urease inhibition project. So urease inhibitors have been tried for various conditions before. So, for example, in the gut, Helicobacter pylori that causes gastric ulcers associated with gastric cancers, that survives because it uses a urease enzyme on the outside of its cell wall to make ammonia and buffer the stomach acid. And there is good evidence in the literature that if you genetically knock out the urease, H. pylori can't survive. Now, we've done some theoretical docking studies with a crystalline computer model of Helicobacter pylori urease, and demonstrated that our multiple urease inhibitors have different docking mechanisms at the site, and we can inactivate it, which means we hope we've made a new antibiotic. Further on in the gut, we believe that, well, farmers have been using urease inhibitors for some time in animals. So if you block out the urease in the gut, urea is then free to cycle into other useful amino acids and be absorbed. So you can increase the yield of your animals through urease inhibition. The problem is synthetic versions often make the animals unwell. We think we can overcome that problem because we're coming from a natural product and we've got multiple different urease inhibitors with a synergistic effect. We're not relying on one molecule at a high dose. So we think we can have an action in the foregut with Helicobacter pylori and in the midgut with regards to urease inhibition and improving protein absorption in the same way as happens with animals. And that, of course, has got a massive implication for frailty. Because where we've got frail adults with this thing, sarcopenia or age-related muscle loss, if we can, instead of giving people lots and lots of sugar and fat and protein, regulate how their gut manages the protein and increase their efficiency, that might be a more effective way of managing them. And similarly, if people get a funny condition called, I say funny, it's a horrible condition called hepatic encephalopathy, secondary to liver cirrhosis, that's all mediated by ammonia. We might have benefit there. We might have benefit in the urease, in the urinary system, because struvite kidney stone formation, some recurrent urinary tract infections, all mediated by the urease enzyme. That's, so urease inhibition is really exciting for us. The other thing we're aware of is this group of molecules, which I mentioned earlier, the isothiocyanates. Now, they're really interesting for us. Watercress has got a predominance of one called phenethyl isothiocyanate, or PEITC. It's actually a plant stress response. So when the cow or the horse comes along and munches on the watercress, a group of molecules called glucosinolates get acted on by a myrosinase enzyme. It makes PEITC. That's what gives watercress its pepperiness. It's a plant deterrent system to stop the the cow or the animal or whatever eating it, we've come to quite like it. What's really interesting is the PEITC has been shown to have a role in regulating inflammation and epigenetic inflammation. So it can actually switch off some cancer genes and switch on some survival genes. And we're showing that, or people are showing now, that PEITC may have an adjunctive role, not only in inflammation, but also in anti-cancer therapy.
Wow. So, Carl, let's be direct. With the R&D that you've done, where you've progressed and progressed with watercress, are we going to be seeing this on the shelf, in Boots, or incorporated in our foods any day soon? Or is it, are we just dreaming here?
No, I absolutely think we are going to. Our roadmap is we had to pick the route which could get us to market first to make funds. That's been the topical route. So we're now working with a continence care provider. We've got a clinical trial on the go, and we hope that very soon we will have a continence care range in collaboration with this company for nappy rash adult incontinence, which in a frail elderly population, which is only getting bigger, is a massive problem.
Yep.
So we think that the topical route's where we're going to go, obviously with this new anti-inflammatory mechanism that we've discovered through PEITC, we may be able to have a positive effect in pro-inflammatory skin conditions, eczema, psoriasis, sunburn. So that's where we're going to be for the next 6 months. While we're doing that, we're going to be going through the Food Standards Agency for a novel food application because we're making an extract. Once we have that, then we are going to be opening this up to everyone who wants it. And then we've got the supply with a fantastic watercress company. We've got a great deal with them. We've got a patent on the production of what we're doing. And I think the other thing for us to just to know is when we make our extract, we also cleave off a new plant protein. So we've actually cleaved off a protein from watercress, which is very, very high in essential amino acids. And this came about by complete fluke because watercress curdles when you heat it because of the protein content. Okay. So we hope that by the back end of this year, we will be able to offer a urease inhibiting PEITC rich liquid extract full of vitamins and minerals, maybe targeted towards frailty in the adult population, maybe as a sports supplement, or maybe just as something to add in foods, alongside this high quality, high in essential amino acid, protein fiber powder as well.
Carl, rockstar number three, what an amazing story. Can everyone come back in, please? And whilst we're all coming back in, Rob, if you could just hear this this question from myself. So you got someone like Carl who's virtually there to market. We're seeing a sort of a gold rush in fresh produce and the likes of people trying to get into vertical farming or people trying to set up online data platforms within fresh produce. Rob, do you think there's going to be now a bit of a gold rush of companies trying to get involved on a health and a fresh produce collaboration? Do you think we're on the verge of something big happening within fresh produce?
So I think something that is occurring is you've got this sort of interlinking of this sort of vertical farming, indoor farming, and the health elements. Okay, because if you've got a vertical farm and an indoor farm, you've got a completely controlled environment, then that gives you the opportunity to actually manipulate the biochemistry through changing the physical environment. And not only can you do that, but it means that you can produce something that's really, really consistent. So for example, for what Carl's wanting to do, he's actually making products from the produce. And if you've got a really consistent feed into that, it means you get something really consistent out the other side. So I think where those two come together, there are some real opportunities available.
Okay. Barbara, what's your take on this? Are we seeing the start of something significant with examples that we've had from Rob and Carl?
I think we are. And there seems to be sort of a background noise around nutraceuticals and people realising the benefit of using plant materials and not just having healthy foods. I think it's important that we do that micronutrient enrichment that Rob was talking about. But I think there's also timing that's part of that. So if you look at some of the work that was done 10 years ago on selenium enrichment and things like spinach and tomatoes, whether people were ready for that, I don't know. But I think now everybody's a bit more conscious about maintaining good immune health. So they're interested in micronutrients. But at the same time, I think we need to step away from just looking at consumers and talk about citizens. Everybody needs to eat. And I think some people are getting their food through the education system, the work system, the prison system. Not everybody is buying food outright. So we need to look at institutions and how we can get them to have better procurement practices that are taking in higher quality raw materials to feed to people. And then you've also got all the benefits that go with doing that research around the nutraceuticals and how you can have added value as well. So there are so many things to tap into in that rich seam of fresh produce. I'm really excited.
I'm amazed by it. Mark, one thing that we've always majored on these broadcasts is the sustainability element of it. This approach, is that I'm slightly plagiarising a fantastic question from Avril here, on the basis of this new approach, how's it going to incorporate the sustainability considerations that we're all trying to achieve? Mark, what are your thoughts, please?
Well, that's a big question. I certainly think there needs to be a reframing of the way we think about agriculture and food systems from what I'd call a very kind of productivist approach, really, that's incentivized food production systems, whether they're nutrient rich, nutrient dense, or those food systems that provide lots of foods with empty calories, energy dense. Our production systems have tended to support the commodification of those foods. Even foods that are full of calories and energy dense that aren't particularly great for our health. So salts, sugars, fats, we've heard all about that. So I do think we need to look more radically at incentivizing food systems to support what I would call a sustainable nutrition transition. And we've talked around a lot of the kind of technological innovations, vertical farming, all that kind of stuff is great, but we also have to remember, you know, we're looking at this from a global perspective. There are 1 billion plus smallholder farmers out there. Often they're suffering from hunger and malnutrition, often producing food for the export market rather than for the domestic market. So we have to look at kind of policies and practices that would support what I would call more regenerative agroecological forms of food production. So growing crops that are more suited to the cultural and climatic conditions within their own cultures or geography. Yeah. So we need to focus on things like what I would call orphan or forgotten crops. You know, 70-80% of globally traded calories come from 8 to 10 globally traded food products, yet there are 70,000 edible varieties of food out there. We need to start investing in some of those nutrient-rich alternatives that will improve soil health, will improve biodiversity, resilient to climate change, and improve health and nutritional outcomes. You know, that requires policies and politics to really support and level up the playing field, in my view, to those forms of practice.
And everyone, that's why Mark Driscoll is, in my view, one of the foremost experts in sustainability within fresh food. Someone's just nicked the question from Avril that Rob's was going to answer live. And I was just... Rob, if you can remember the question, I'm just going to see if Rachel and I can handle this sort of hand-in-hand over our bowl of watercress soup. Rachel, in the respect of changes that might happen to plant or plant technology, do you think there's a way that we can use the World Obesity Federation to pass that message on that good things have been done with plants, with fresh food, and as such that you, the population, you the citizen, as Barbara said, you should enjoy it more. How can we get this message to people to enjoy more fresh produce, do you think, Rachel?
Yeah, great question. And I do believe there is so much potential in applying the amazing work of advertising strategists that sell cars and alcohol and all these other things and fast food to healthy foods. And whether that's about creating brands or thinking differently about brands, I'm not sure. Of course, taste has to be there as well. But we, you know, social media is so powerful and none of us are using it to our advantage. The challenge is it can be really expensive to run really kind of sophisticated marketing campaigns. But I think that, you know, if that would be something that would seem to be mutually beneficial. You know, you sell more fresh fruits and vegetables and certainly from the, you know, kind of the health perspective, you're going to be getting people eating more healthy food. So I think that's a really kind of untapped area that I know that have been some good campaigns. Like in the UK, there was called Peas Please that went a while. Yeah, I'm sure you know about. And there are, they do come up and things, but it's not kind of instituted in the kind of the day-to-day, in our day-to-day lives. So I would like to see more of that. And yeah, I do also think, to picking up on Barbara's point, that we're riding like a health wave right now. People know that health is important. People know that to be healthy, they need to eat the right food. But we all need, that's where I think kind of the policy and the private sector bits fits together, because we need to make equity of access, and of course we need the desirability as well, and the demand as well. But we need to be, yeah, I think that, again, to pick up on Barbara's point, the procurement in schools. But this is where I think a kind of a travesty that hospitals, you can't necessarily get a healthy meal in a hospital. That is just I think that is such a potent symbol of what is wrong, but also what I think can be fixed quite easily.
Rachel, well done. Rob, if you want to just go back to that question that I think you probably answered online, but isn't the market, Rob, coming towards you because we do want to eat more healthy food? So with everything that you talked about in our deep dive interview, in the respect of looking for partners, looking for retailers, surely you're in the winning seat here, aren't you, Rob?
I certainly hope so. But obviously, I think, you know, as I say, it's quite important that, because a lot of this is quite high risk, we need that government support, because, you know, and some of these projects are fairly long term as well. Yeah. So if you're looking at taking this over the long term, and people need that return before they can make that financial input. And again, a lot of the growers are suffering from quite small margins. So I think what we need is an ecosystem where this research can be supported. And maybe the way to bring that about is to think not only about the short-term financial gain for the companies, but the long-term sort of economic gains that we might see from having a better a population that's got a better nutrition, you know. And I can see Rachel nodding her head furiously there. So,
Jackie, what's your view in the respect of you know growers, you know farmers better than most? Do you think there would be advocates of everything that Rachel, Kyle, and Rob are doing or looking to do, or are they going to be like proverbial sheep and they're just going to wait for someone else to do it and then they might join? What are your thoughts?
Oh, this is really the perennial discussion, really, because this isn't about competitive advantage. This is about the health of the planet. Both the humans and the planet in its broadest sense. So for me, having certainty to invest, you know, as Rob's just said, you're never going to have certainty. You know, you're going to have to kiss quite a few frogs, I imagine, to find the prince. But it takes people like the Watercress Company and Carl to actually just go for it. And there will be nuggets in and amongst that. And I think you're right when you say that this is around policy, it is around politics. There's plenty of funding available. And what just came to mind for me was that this is a classic example of where sort of farming and agriculture, health and I guess food just don't really come together in our political kind of ecosystem. And if they did, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So it's just systemic. We need to get everybody talking as we are today.
Yeah. Barbara, remind me, haven't we talked about this on previous broadcasts about the Dutch diamond of government, of industry and of education? I hope I've got that right. The three of them collaborate. And that's one of the reasons why the fresh produce sector in the likes of Holland is so strong, because there is that collaboration. But I suppose in some ways we've got to create it ourselves, and hence why we've got Rob, and hence why we've got Kyle. Just Barbara, just going to move on to Kyle, because we're slightly running out of time. Kyle, did you see that question from that anonymous attendee?
I haven't yet. No, let me have a...
Because I want you to read it, because there's some big words in there that I can't read, but I'll be fascinated to hear your answer. So it's the second one down. Go on, I can do the very interesting. You take it over from there.
I mean, I think the question's absolutely right. So the question here asking about the use of probiotics and prebiotics to control Helicobacter pylori, and looking at herbal Chinese medicine and other things like that. Absolutely, I'd love to do it. At the minute, I'm swamped with all the watercress potential that's coming through. But in time, I absolutely want to start looking at the Chinese medicine, traditional medicines, and trying to understand the biochemical pathways that are underpinning the benefits that people are seeing. And this is what we've done through history. you know, people were chewing the bark of a willow tree to get rid of joint pain. That's aspirin. You get digoxin, which I use regularly for heart arrhythmias, from foxglove. There's all sorts of potential here. And I think one of the points around sustainability, which is interesting for myself, is working with someone like the Watercress Company. Their product has got a finite shelf life. So if it can't be sold, it would have to be thrown away. What we're offering is a way of turning that into something with a much longer shelf life. And we could be quite reactive in taking a lot of product if there's a lot left over, and other times not taking too much. So I think in terms of a sort of economic model and sustainability, it works really well. But, and I'm going back to that question, absolutely, that's what we want to be doing, looking at other plants, extending our reach. And certainly I'm well aware of the probiotic use in H. pylori and in the gut with these new things like fecal transplants and things like that, which are becoming very interesting. So no, it's definitely on our radar.
I Carl, to help you, do you basically need money? Do you basically need investment to give you more headspace, more of a team to be able to do this further R&D?
The next stage is going to be upscaling. So we are going to have to take on some funding to get to the stage where we can produce this in enough volumes that we can supply stuff to trials. What we really want to do is collaborate. So, for example, with nappy rash, there is no point in me setting up a nappy factory. I want to go to someone who's already established and collaborate. The same in agriculture and the same in the food and drink sector. So I'm basically here waving my hand saying, we have something very special. We want to collaborate with someone who's already established in the market, who knows the market, and do a joint partnership. That's what we're after.
Well done. And Carl, I don't know if you saw the bottom question from Deborah David, or David Deborah. I'm sorry, hope I got the right way around. Amazing Watercress Research. Any reading references to read more on this? Carl, if you're okay to just answer that directly online, that'd be fantastic. Rob, just hopping back to yourself. I see a bit of a similarity here as to what's potentially going to happen in the respect of all this interest of people trying to get into this this area, and that with vertical farming. With vertical farming, there's been such a, here comes the word again, gold rush, and there's a view that 90% of the companies involved in vertical farming won't be here in 3 years' time because they will have all vanished and ran out of money. To perhaps stop that in this circumstance within this really important area, over and above collaboration, what would your advice be, Rob, to make sure that there's not this overlapping of people doing research and development, instead everyone's working as one team? Or am I being naive? What's the answer to that?
No, I mean, I think it's building on what you know. So clearly the growers are best at growing, and they're very good at taking on board new management technologies and introducing those new technologies. The breeding companies and the seed companies are best at breeding and doing that sort of work. So I think it's about communication between the different groups and people playing to their strengths and bringing those strengths together to actually deliver to market. And again, I know I keep coming back to it, but there is money there from government to allow us to do this. And I think these are really valuable interventions that the government is making to help support the UK food system.
Yeah, and with this housing call, that there might be fundamental changes to the NHS, because let's look at this on a basic term, everyone. If we are eating badly, we're putting such a huge cost on the NHS. The NHS, bless them, nearly broke over the COVID scenario. We don't want that to happen again. As I think, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was either Jackie or Barbara said that with COVID, that we're definitely going to see positive changes from this, but it's got to be driven further forward. Barbara, do you think that we will be able to get to that housing point where there is this marriage between fresh produce and the healthcare scenario to create that collaboration?
I think there is, where there's a financial advantage, definitely, but I also think it shouldn't just be left to the market. It should also be facilitated at a policy level, because leaving things for somebody to invent and then finding the money, it'll take too long. So if you look at the struggle that Kyle's had to go through, you know, if we had a setup like the Dutch Diamond, where he could just knock on the door of the office next to him and say, right, this is my idea, and he gets handed the cash and goes off and does it, it would be so much more streamlined. So if you look at how, you know, the Oxford vaccine came together in like less than 8 months, if everything was set up for success, that's where we would be with all these inventions that were helping solve problems and improve human lives. But unfortunately, we're not set up like that, and we're waiting for the market to come up with solutions. And to me, that's just half the plan. We need to make it a more systematic way of collaboration, where things are facilitated for success and not the way they are at the moment.
Carl, you're the man on the ground. Is Barbara right or incorrect?
No, I think so. And you know, we were extremely lucky with Torbay Medical Research Fund down by where we are in South Devon. They had a call. We applied. We were shortlisted within a couple of weeks. We were pitching within a couple of weeks of that. And we received the funding a couple of weeks after that. So 6 weeks.
Wow.
A lot of the big funding charities, you know, there is a lot of information to read. The application process can be up to a year and you might have a 20% success rate. Now, for me, as what's effectively a sole person running a company, I can't afford that time out if that's the risk associated with it. You know, we've got a really compelling story. And as Barbara said, if there were the funds available that we can go to and say, look, we're proper people, we're proper scientists, we're proper doctors, we've been working on this for some time, I think it should be fundable a lot quicker than having a year-long application process.
Yeah, well said. Everyone, we're just about to run out of time. We've always dictated on this broadcast that we want a really good call to action. And if one thing I've learned from these broadcasts and these podcasts is that people should really go away having learned five new things. We've got seven experts here. So my challenge to you all is, what is your call to action on this subject of how we can collaborate between fresh produce and the healthcare system? What is the route to success? What is the call to action? Rob, can we start with you, please?
I think we need to understand the mechanisms and use the expertise that are already there.
Okay. And do you think we will see success?
Oh, absolutely. There'll be a lot of failures because that's the nature of research and that's the nature of bringing products to market. But there will undoubtedly be successes.
Okay. And just, Rob, I just want to drive this home again. What would you like from this platform, from our connections, to help you and your team?
I'd like people who have an interest in bringing a new product to market or bringing a new understanding of what they're growing to us, and we can help them to achieve what they want to achieve.
Fantastic. And you can find Rob Hancock by putting him into LinkedIn or looking further afield. And Rob, are you going to come to that pub with me for that watercress soup?
I would love to come and enjoy some watercress soup with you, perhaps with some watercress on the side.
Fantastic. Jackie, come on. What's the call to action for this fantastic broadcast, please, from your perspective?
Obviously, eat more watercress. I want to know what sum of money we're up to. I think for me, it's this engagement, really, that we need to just be brave and come up with ideas, recognizing that they're going to fail because they, you know, you need to have several failures to get to a success. So as Barbara said, let's all help each other and campaign, I guess, through our MPs, through government, local government, through federations, to have a culture where innovation thrives and where people aren't scared to have a go. I think what we've heard today is that if people have a go, it can create amazing things. So
yeah, and Jackie, well done. And it's interesting that we've come back to this Dutch diamond model again, that there seems to be this reoccurring theme, and it's perhaps something that we should investigate further. So Rachel, what's your call to action for all of us from yourself and the World Obesity Federation, please?
Okay, so yeah, especially now when we're all, let's face it, at home and in our immediate vicinities, my call to action is actually think and look locally more, which goes against my role, which is global. But I would say we can make stuff happen at the local level. And there's a lot of innovation happening, especially around like COVID mutual aid, like councils actually and community groups really coming together, food and health, people with different interests. So look around, look at your local thing, even if it's just, you know, in the course of this pandemic, I think there's a lot that can be done. And then, of course, it's such a critical time. So many people without access to nutritious food. My call to action is to look and think locally. And also, I have to do it. World Obesity Day is on the 4th of March next week.
Fantastic.
And go to www.worldobesity.org.
Well, Rachel, could you just say that again? Just give us the website again for World Obesity Day.
worldobesityday.org, which is our annual day. So if you want to find out more about obesity and what needs to be done, please check it out. And there'll be lots of stuff happening on that day. And yeah, please be in touch.
Fantastic. So we Beanstalk, we'll definitely look out for that. And we'll look to share and like it. And can you just mention your favourite fresh produce, beginning with W again, Rachel, please?
Oh, I'm a big, big watercress fan. I love watercress. I eat it every day. I eat watercress every day.
Fantastic. Mark, call to action from the back of yourself as our sustainability expert and our other experts. What's your call to action, please?
So I agree, lots of mention around the Dutch diamond. Let's create a UK diamond. And I think the biggest opportunity is fresh produce sector coming together with health sector, sustainability, to really advocate for more kind of research development in this issue, and for, you know, policies that support those kind of nutrient rich foods.
Yeah, but we're going to have to go offline, online, and to discuss this Dutch diamond and create the Spalding diamond, or whatever we're going to call it. And Mark, can you just confirm that you've got watercress in your fridge?
I have watercress in my fridge, and in my garden, in fact.
There we go, Kyle. Come on, you're with everything, all the good stuff that you're doing. I don't know how you do it, being a doctor on one side and creating miracles on the other side. What's your call to action for us all to learn, please?
Well, the reason I've managed so well is in the funding pitch, as it's a TMRF, they said this looks like it might be worth a punt, and they were expecting it to fail. And I think my call to arms for everyone else is roll the dice, take a gamble. If someone's doing something that is truly novel, it of course is going to have risk because of the unknowns. But if they're a sensible person, they've got a sensible background, and they're absolutely dedicated to make it work, they probably will have a very good chance of doing it. So take a punt.
Boom. Barbara, your call to action and to wrap... Oh, sorry, Kyle. What was that company that's helping you again? I've completely forgotten.
The watercress company, the one and only.
And what do they grow?
A bit of watercress and wasabi, but mainly watercress.
Excellent. Barbara, to wrap up, your call to action, please. And if you'd like to summarise as well, that'd be amazing.
Well, my call to action is to take the learnings of what we have today around collaboration and come onto that platform, Healthy and Sustainable Food. Sign up, because that's where you're going to see incredible speakers who've shared their stories over the last 6 months, and be able to engage with all of the different businesses and stories that we've heard across the disciplines of finance, education, agriculture, food industry, pharma, medicine. I think it's your one opportunity to see all of those things happening in one place. So do log on to Healthy and Sustainable Food and watch what we're doing and join in. Share your story so we can have more exciting broadcasts and help other people get to the position of being able to achieve what they want to do in the fresh produce sector and helping get more healthy and sustainable food out to our communities.
And I think with what I've learned today is that we've got our three rock stars, being Barbara, Mark and Jackie, but to have these three additional rock stars of Rob, Rachel and Kyle, and all credit to Barbara, Jackie and Mark for sourcing them, because I think we've learned so much today as to another commercial avenue for fresh produce, but an avenue that's actually going to do good. And I know we use this word so often, and Rachel was so right about everyone talking about collaboration, but it does feel very genuine. So if you want to reach out to the likes of Rob and Kyle in the respect of, if you're a fresh produce company and you want to do more, do good, reach out to them. And likewise, let's all support Rachel and her team at the World Obesity Federation to really drive World Obesity Day. Everyone, thank you very much. This has been fascinating. And it would be great if we could actually create this this British diamond to duplicate the success from the Dutch diamond method. Let's, fingers crossed, let's see what happens. Thank you, everyone. Keep safe and we'll see you at the next broadcast. Thank you, everyone. Oh, watercress. Can everyone just mention watercress?
Watercress.
Watercress.
Watercress. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.